Welcome to a sermon podcast from the Unitarian Church of Los Alamos, New Mexico. Whoever you are, wherever you are on your life's journey, you are welcome here.
This sermon is entitled, The Evolution of Monotheism, and was delivered by James Carroll on July 1st, 2018.
Our first reading is from the Greek philosopher Xenophanes, who wrote, "But if cattle and horses and lions had hands or could paint with their hands and create works such as men do, horses like horses and cattle like cattle would also depict the gods, shapes, and make their bodies of such sort as the form they themselves have. Ethiopians say their gods are flat-nosed and black. Thracians, that they are pale and red-haired. Rather, one god, greatest among the gods and humans, like mortals neither in form nor in thought." The second reading is from the book of Deuteronomy in the Hebrew Bible. "When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the sons of El. But Jehovah's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted inheritance." Three of the world's great religions would be best classified as monotheistic, but monotheism is a relatively new innovation, not something we've really seen for the majority of human history, which seems possibly surprising to us today, since we're so steeped in it. It seems like the obvious answer. But for years it was not. All three of those great monotheistic religions trace their monotheism to a single character, Abraham, who stands as a giant among giants in the history of mythology. The problem with this is that there is no ambiguous reference to monotheism in any of the stories, the original stories we have about Abraham, depending on what we mean by original. By that, I mean in the stories of Genesis. There are at least three different sources to be found in Genesis, but none of them place unambiguous monotheism into the worship of Abraham. Not E, not J, and not even P, which was written latest of all. So where did monotheism actually come from if it did not come from Abraham? The answer is that it evolved, much like we did, gradually and over time. This is the story, or at least my attempt to tell the story, of the evolution of monotheism. You can think of it as the story of the very first ancient Unitarians. They were the first monotheists. The story, however, matters, not just because of its academic roots, but because it impacts our society today. What we think God is determines how we think about him, and that determines what we're willing to do in his name. Once we conceive of God as singular, it's easy to assume that all morality, all right and wrong, come from him. And if we create that being then in our own image, then he shares our politics, our beliefs, and those beliefs can be imposed on others by violent means if necessary, or we can be motivated by the same beliefs to help, share, feed the homeless and the sick, and make the world a better place. It all depends on how we conceive of God and where it came from. So the history of that thought, I believe, is important. Whatever conclusion you come to from the history, we need to know the history of where the idea came from. From what we can tell, our earliest ancestors were what we call animistic. Animism is the belief that all things have a spirit, a soul, an essence that dwells within them, not just ourselves, but the rocks, the trees, the rivers, the streams, the oceans, but ourselves and you and me and our neighbors as well. Let me try to help you know if this idea is alien to you. Let me try to help you feel where it comes from. I loved my grandparents dearly. They recently passed away. Not recently. They passed away when I was young. I also loved my dog. Not quite the same, but he has been a member of my family for longer than my son. and she recently passed away. On my wall next to my door are these two pictures, one of my grandparents and one of my son with our dog. When I look at those pictures, I feel something. It's as if they're there looking out at me, and I'm reminded of who they were, what they meant to me, and what my life with them was like. It's as if they have a soul. And that soul lives not just in the being of my grandparents and the dog, but in their image and in the representations of them. They carry with them some feeling, some sense of who the people were. This is the animating force and the psychological reasoning that motivates animism. Because when we look at a tree, we feel something. When we look at a painting, we see something. And here we have on the right what's called the image of the Magi? No, that's not right. It's one of the earliest cave paintings, and I just forgot what people call it. I don't know why. In any event, the sorcerer. There we go. It's thought to be one of the earliest depictions of God, because in this particular cave where it resides along the ceiling, presiding over the other images below it. It's a depiction of a ram-headed being with horns, an erect phallus, and human-like feet and legs. And it is what we think, the earliest depiction of God. What I'm going to try to describe is how the concept of a deity grows out of animism. You see, once you believe that an image of something carries with it the spirit of the thing, you begin making images yourself to depict the spirit of the things that you're trying to bring to mind, in this case, fertility rituals, idols, designed to help you bring about fertility, either of women, of ourselves, of our cattle, or of the land, because these things also carry with them a spirit, just as the land itself does. And by having the image in front of us, much as the image of my son and our dog brings to mind my relationship with that animal, so these images brought to mind the relationship people wanted to have with the world around them. This, of course, leads naturally to ancestor worship. Think of the picture I have of my grandparents. If I feel that their spirit is there with me, it's very easy to start praying to them because, after all, they have moved into the unseen world ahead of me, and perhaps they can make intercession with me for either the deities or for the power of the spiritual world itself to make sure my crops succeed, that my wife becomes pregnant, that we can have children, these sorts of things. This is a picture of a family shrine where the individuals had been buried under the shrine and offerings were placed on top to the ancestors. This one's from Mesopotamia in Ur. This also leads to polytheism. Now, I can't do justice to these ideas. I have whole lectures on comparative religion that I hope you will come to and enjoy, but I'm going to try to hit the highlights. I believe that ancestor worship and polytheism go hand in hand, because once you have the same concept of animism, once you have the concept of beseeching your ancestors for things, the next simple thing to do is to beseech the elements themselves, to beseech the sky, to beseech the water, to beseech the other forces of nature. So these individual gods start out as forces of nature, but we personify the forces. And why do we do that? It's because the only conscious experience we have access to is our own. And so if we're going to presume that there is a consciousness in the forces of nature, we have no way to conceive of that except to think of that consciousness like we think of our own. Of course, we have reasons, psychological reasons, for thinking that there is consciousness out there. Evolution helped us be social creatures by helping us have a theory of mind so that when you behave in a certain way, I create a theory that says he's behaving in that way because he has a mind that is like my mind. Therefore, he behaves in that way because he's angry, because he's sad. This is hardwired into us, and it helps us exist as conscious and social creatures. But it also predisposes us to see consciousness elsewhere, not just in our neighbors, but in the tree, in the rock, in the wind, in the rain, in the oceans. Once we see consciousness there, we begin to personify them. We build them in our own image. Whereas these deities were created in our image, not us in theirs, but they in ours. In fact, the Mesopotamians had so many of these deities and they created so many stories about them that they had to compile very complex god lists to keep track of all of them. As I said, most of them were the personification of nature, but some of them became personifications of other things like kingship. And other more abstract concepts began to also have personified deities. To worship these deities, they created idols. Now, we in the West relate to idols culturally through the Bible's critique of idol worship. The Bible essentially says, people who worship stone and trees, the work of their hands, are stupid. Why not worship the creator of the trees instead of the tree itself? Why do we worship the work of our own hands? That's the critique. It is essentially a straw man. Idols were conceived of through animism. Every self-respecting polytheist who had an idol would not believe that they were worshiping the idol. They believed they were worshiping the deity that the idol represents. They would, however, take it a step further and say that the idol contained within it the spirit of the deity, in the same way that the picture of my son contains and my recently deceased dog contains their spirit, that I can feel something when I look at them, their animating spirit. So they tried to create something that looked like the thing they were trying to worship in order for that thing to house within it some of that essence of the thing they're worshiping. This is a very complex idea and one that's sometimes hard for us to grasp, but it is quite distinct from the straw man the Bible gives us for idols and idol worship. The next stage in this evolution has to do with city-states. You see, when people began gathering themselves together in cities, they began to have what they called patron deities. You see, there was one god who was the patron deity of the city, and the city next door would have its patron. This moved us from polytheism, where we worshiped many gods, to a form of polytheism where there was one god that was supported by the state, supported by the city. And we would worship that god if you lived in this city. And if you went to the other city, you would worship a different deity. By the way, this shows up in the Bible where people talk about needing to go to a certain city to worship Jehovah. So this is this idea that gods have patron cities and you're supposed to go to that specific city to worship that god. And that that god's worship was most important in that city. Not that the other gods didn't exist, but that that's where you worship that god. These cities were very soon at war with each other, and they viewed those wars as contests between the gods. You see, if my city defeated your city, it was because my patron deity was better than your patron deity. And people would pray to their patron deity for protection from the battles with each other. Once one city began to conquer lots of others, we had the first empires, and the view of the gods shifted to match. This is a depiction of a scene from the Enuma Elish, which is the creation account of Babylon. In this creation account, you see the gods were organized into a assembly. It's called the Divine Assembly. That's because each city-state was led by a divine assembly. The divine assembly picked the king, in fact. Well, once you had one city-state with its king ruling over all the others, the king took over and the divine assembly went the way of the dodo. Very strong move away from democracy, I might add. And what we have in the gods is a new creation story where an unknown god, Marduk, just happened to be the patron deity of Babylon, suddenly became the king of the gods. You see, in the story, the divine assembly itself is dissolved. And suddenly, Marduk, the patron deity of Babylon, becomes king over all the other gods because Babylon had conquered all the other city-states around it. In fact, they went one step further. They started to talk about their kings. This one is Naram-Sin wearing the helmet of a deity. Show the deity on the left, Naram-Sin on the right. So suddenly their kings became gods in their own right. So not only do the gods look like people, people begin to become gods, and those gods are kings, ruling over other gods, etc. So what we have here is a hierarchy of deities, where one deity is worshipped as supreme, or better than the other deities. Not that the other deities don't exist, but one god is supreme. This is called henotheism. So monolatry differs from monotheism in that it is the worship of a single god without denying the existence of the others. Henotheism is the belief that one god is superior to the others and rules over the other gods. In fact, once you relegate the other gods to angels, the difference between henotheism and monotheism is very small. All you have to do is turn the other deities into angels, and suddenly you've become a monotheist. The evolution of henotheism in the pagan world came through the political organization of empires. So, what were the first experiments in monotheism? We see how we lead up to it. The first real recorded example we have is from Amenhotep IV. His wife was the very famous Queen Nefertiti. Everyone's heard about her, but few know the story. Amenhotep was a funny-looking guy. He made statues of himself that looked different from every other Egyptian statue pharaoh ever. And he also changed his name to Akhenaten because he worshipped this guy, the sun deity, Aten, who was never drawn in human form, which is bizarre. Egyptian gods always were drawn in human form, but this one was drawn as the sun disk, and the only anthropomorphic element is these little hands that reach down and grab things and help you out. It's the rays of the sun shining down upon you and granting beneficence unto you. And his new name, Akhenaten, means it's beneficial to the Aten. At first, he simply preferred the worship of Aten to the worship of the other gods. But very quickly, he began to do something a little different. He said, Aten is the only god who exists, and the other gods do not exist. That's monotheism. See, monotheism is a form of atheism. It's not a belief in one god or worship of one god. It's a belief that every god doesn't exist except for yours. As such, it is a form of atheism minus one. And again, what marks monotheism is not the belief in one god. That exists all over the place. It's the denial of the existence of the other deities. And when Akhenaten moved from monolatry into monotheism, he became violent. And we have one of the earliest religious purges known. His armies went from place to place, putting down all the other temples, destroying their idols, and forcing the people, at the point of the sword, to worship only one god. His revolution did not outlast his death. As soon as he died, his very young son changed his name to Tutankhamun, back to the worship of Amun, and that is our famous King Tut, who was the only Egyptian pharaoh whose tomb was not desecrated, mostly because he and his entire father were erased from the king list and no one knew to look for him. And his tomb therefore survived, and that's why he's the famous King Tut. But it's related to this experiment, the first experiment in monotheism that failed spectacularly and was also marked by extreme violence. The next real, I think, experiment comes from the Greek philosophers. The Greeks were so good at humanizing their deities, because that makes them relatable. Zeus is a dad, he's got lots of kids, he has lots of affairs. You humanize these deities, and then they have a personality, and you're better able to relate to them. They become so relatable, though, as people, that people begin to realize that they can't take them seriously as gods. Xenophanes, who I read earlier, said, if cattle and horses created a god, they would create a god who looked like a cattle or a horse. We are creating gods in our image, is what he's saying, and therefore he doesn't believe in them. He proposes something altogether different, a god without form. This sounds an awful lot like Atenism that was first proposed by Akhenaten. And it is one of the, again, earlier expressions of monotheism. But they come at it from a philosophical perspective. What they're looking for, among other things, is the prime mover. In other words, I do what I do because it's been caused. My actions were caused by my genetics, my parents, my environment, and they were looking for something that was its own cause, that wasn't dependent on something else. And so they came up with the concept of the prime mover, what they called the logos. It's the thing that causes all other things, the first cause. The next experiment in monotheism. Now, by the way, that experiment, the Greek philosophical experiment, never died, but it never caught on either. People had a hard time relating to a first cause. They wanted a person they could play to who would talk to them like a person. So the next experiment in monotheism came from the Zoroastrians. And in this case, it's not entirely monotheistic. You see, what they want is a god who they can look up to. The gods of the Mesopotamians and the gods of the Persians were not terribly, well, they would explain evil in the world by having gods who acted in evil ways. They wanted something they could look up to. We all want that. And to create that, they had to create a god who was all-powerful, but who was also all-good. And the problem with that is then you have to explain, if God is all-powerful and all-good, then why is there evil? And so the Zoroastrian answer is there is also a powerful and evil deity. There are two deities, one good, one evil. From this idea, we get this dualism. It's not quite monotheism, but it's close. It's a step closer, because now we have a deity who is supposedly good and powerful, who is at war with an evil deity, and the war is over the souls of men. And God will judge the souls of men in the next life, and we'll either go to a heaven or a hell. This is the first real expression of this idea of a heaven and hell. It comes in Zoroastrianism. Now, we've set the stage. Let's turn our eyes for just a moment back to Abraham. If Abraham doesn't express monotheism, what is he doing? Well, what he does looks an awful lot like monolatry and henotheism. You see, Abraham lives somewhere in Mesopotamia, and a god named El comes to Abraham and says, "Let me take you somewhere better." And he takes Abraham, and Abraham says, "I will go." And he travels from somewhere in Mesopotamia to the land of Canaan. It just so happens, however, the land of Canaan worshipped a god named El. In fact, they called him El Shaddai, El Elyon, and they had several names for him. But he was an elderly, fatherly figure. We'll talk a little more about him in a bit. But Abraham in the text worships El in groves, and he erects pillars to God, to El. And all of this matches perfectly what we know about Canaanite worship of the deity El. This is El. Meet El Elyon, the original father deity who sits bearded upon a throne, dressed in gold. He was also symbolized by an ox, which gives extra context to the golden calf that the Israelites build when they come out of Egypt. You remember this story? We'll come back to that. This is El, and this is almost certainly the god that Abraham worshipped. God made a covenant with Abraham. God, El, made a covenant with Abraham that if Abraham would travel, go to the new land, worship El, El would give him posterity as numerous as the stars of heaven, and the land of Israel would be his, although then it was called the land of Canaan. Weirdly enough, El was worshipped in the land of Canaan. Abraham also, in one of the more bizarre stories in the biblical text, transforms suddenly from a pastoral shepherd to a mighty warlord who goes off fighting and conquering and capturing the people who had taken Lot captive, if you remember this story. And he brings Lot home, and he also brings all these spoils of war home. This story is almost certainly from a different source, because it paints a very different picture of Abraham, possibly even an earlier source. And once he brings all this stuff home, he wanders over to the king, Melchizedek. Melchizedek means the king of righteousness. He is supposedly the king of Salem. Jerusalem means Ir Salem, the city of Salem. He's the king of Jerusalem. But at the time, Jerusalem is a Canaanite city where they worshipped Canaanite gods. And Abraham pays tithes to the king and priest, Melchizedek, priest of a god that Melchizedek calls El Elyon, God Highest. So if there was any doubt that Abraham worshipped the Canaanite god El Elyon, it should be gone by now. Next comes Moses, however. Moses begins his story, his myth, in a way that completely mirrors the Mesopotamian myth of the origins of Sargon, complete with the basket floating in the river, the whole deal. That story is lifted straight out of the Mesopotamian myth of Sargon. And after he flees Egypt, he goes to a land that the Bible calls the land of Midian, and there he meets a guy named Jethro. At least some of the accounts call him Jethro. And Jethro gives Moses his daughter in marriage, Zipporah. So here he is married to Jethro, Jethro's daughter. And it turns out that Jethro is what we call the high priest of Midian. That's interesting because we have at least two references to Jehovah in the early sources outside the Bible, what we will call Yahweh, Yud Heh Vav Heh, or sometimes called Jehovah. There are two references. Both of them describe Yahweh as the god of a wandering nomadic tribe called the Midianites. While Moses is there with the Midianites, he taking care of the high priest of Midian's flocks, he wanders up a mountainside that's sacred to the Midianites, and there he encounters a burning bush. And from the burning bush, we are told, God speaks to him and said, I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob as El Elyon, God Almighty, but by my name, Yahweh, I did not make myself fully known to them. Of course, the idea that El Elyon, the God Abraham worshipped, was actually Yahweh, a Midianite deity, would have come as a great surprise to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob. But here we have a biblical author attempting to merge the concepts of God the highest, El Elyon, and this new deity, the Midianite deity that Moses picks up from his father-in-law. Now, this obviously raises to me the question of whether there actually was an individual named Moses or an individual named Abraham. The historicity of these accounts is an interesting question that I will try to save for later. But when we do the biblical class, we'll probably talk about it when we get that far. But I'll tell you my bias now. I believe that most of these individuals and these myths were created from actual events, actual people that have been embellished, changed, modified, and rewritten over time. There was obviously no grand exodus from Egypt with thousands and thousands of Israelites. The archaeological record rules that out. But the idea that a single individual wandering in the wilderness and intermarried to a Midianite priest might have introduced Jehovah worship to the Canaanites seems perfectly plausible to me, and incredibly likely given the stories we have. So, what kind of worship does Moses bring? Well, according to the text describing Moses, he tells them to build a temple that looks exactly like this temple. In fact, I like to show this temple to my students when I was teaching comparative religion and ask them what it was, and they always said this is the Temple of Solomon until they look more closely, and there's an idol in the back of Asherah. This is a Syrian temple, but the Israelite temple looks exactly like the Syrian temple. The rituals Moses prescribes in Exodus and Leviticus are almost identical to the Canaanite religious rituals that El worship already entailed. In fact, when Joshua supposedly conquers the Promised Land, another one of those stories that don't terribly match up with archaeological evidence, he has a covenant ceremony where the people promise to worship Jehovah. What's most interesting about that covenant is it's not a covenant of monotheism. It's a covenant of monolatry. There is no denial of the existence of the other gods, but in an analogy made to marriage, Israel is married to their God and promises to worship their God in an exclusive way, much as a married person promises to have relations in an exclusive way. And the idea is God will take care of you if you worship me in an exclusive way. And that's the covenant that Joshua gives between the Israelites and their new God, a merger between El and the Midianite deity Yahweh. Which leads us, of course, to the divided monarchy. The northern kingdom of Israel primarily worshipped El, mixed with some other Canaanite deities thrown in. There was some Asherah worship. This is obvious in the Bible. The Bible spends half of its time in Kings complaining about this fact. But the very fact that they spend forever complaining about it means that it was true. The Israelites worship El in a Canaanite and other Canaanite deities. The southern kingdom of Judah primarily worshipped Yahweh and other Canaanite deities. In fact, the destruction of the northern kingdom is blamed by these authors on their polytheism. But that only proves the point, that these nations were primarily polytheistic. When the Most High gave, now here, and this fact is preserved in the biblical texts. So let me show you explicit references to it. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, Most High, Elyon, this is our, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the Ben Elohim, the sons of El. But Jehovah's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted inheritance. You'll notice what they're saying here. El is this older deity living up in heaven who assigns different deities to be worshipped and to be in charge of. This is a reference to the patron deities. And it explicitly says the other deities exist, but claims that Jehovah is the patron deity of Jacob. This is a reference to henotheistic monolatry in the Bible that is very explicit in its reference to the fact that they believed that the other gods existed, but they were supposed to worship one God. We have others. Let the heavens praise your wonders, O Jehovah, your faithfulness in the assembly of the holy ones. Notice the reference to the divine assembly we talked about earlier. For who in the skies can be compared to Jehovah? Who among the heavenly beings is like the Jehovah? A God greatly to be feared in the council of the holy ones. Again, notice that the council of the holy ones exists. And awesome above all who are around him. You see, the censors went through the Bible trying to erase all references to polytheism. They missed some. Who is like you, O Jehovah, among the Elohim, the gods? You notice the reference? You're the greatest. This is henotheistic. You're the greatest of the gods. Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? For you, O Jehovah, are the most high over all the earth. The Most High is a reference to El. You see, now they're merging El and Jehovah. You are exalted above all the gods. Notice the other gods still exist. Okay, which brings us to two reformers, and we're going to have to go very fast. Apologize for this. The first is King Hezekiah, who decides to centralize the worship of Jehovah in Jerusalem. He does this by shutting down all the other temples. This is really good for us because we can actually go to the temples he shuts down and look at them. This is the high place, one of the high places that King Hezekiah shuts down. It's one of the few places you can go where, and sit in a temple dedicated to Jehovah where sacrifices were actually offered to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and look at the altar, which matches the dimensions described in Exodus, and you can wander into the Holy of Holies, if you'd like, and sit upon the throne of God, if you really want to be blasphemous. But once you get there, you notice two things. There are two altars of incense in the Holy of Holies, and next to it are two stone pillars, one slightly smaller than the other. This is the worship of Jehovah and his wife. Now, what's most interesting about this is not only that it's polytheistic, but the next is that Hezekiah, the great reformer who supposedly impacted monotheism in its development by shutting down these other temples, never claims that the other temples are evil or apostate. He just wants to centralize worship in Jerusalem. And this temple is not shut down through desecration. It's very carefully buried in the sand and preserved for archaeologists to look at with reverence. Its accoutrements and materials for worship all buried with it, reverently and respectfully. This is not what you do if you believe that the worship that was happening there was apostate. This is what you do if you centralize the worship in Jerusalem. The next king to instigate reforms is Josiah. His were far more violent. We'll skip most of this. But Josiah is where we begin to see real monotheism appear. He kills people who worship the Canaanite deities, and he says, "You will worship Jehovah and none other, or else." Again, like Akhenaten before him, we see violence associated with the monotheistic reform. He broke the pieces of the altars. He cut down the Asherim, the groves where people worship God's wife, Asherah. And he filled their places with the bones of men. Moreover, the altar was at Bethel in the high place which Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, had made. Even that altar in that high place he broke down. And he burned the high place and stamped it small to powder and burned the Asherah. This is the act of somebody who finds the other worship offensive and apostate, not the acts of Hezekiah. But what turns them all the way from monolatry and henotheism to monotheism? It was an act of extreme trauma. The destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of their temple took the Israelites from Jerusalem to Babylon, where they were slaves. There they met a man named Cyrus the Great, who was the Persian king who set them free after conquering Babylon. Cyrus is a Zoroastrian. So there in captivity, suffering from the destruction of their temple. Now, how would you interpret that if you were an Israelite? The god of Marduk, the Babylons, must be better than Jehovah because Babylon destroyed Israel. If you don't want to accept that, you have to turn to some other belief. Perhaps Marduk himself didn't exist, and the destruction of Jerusalem was due to our own sins. Under the influence of the Persians, the dualistic near monotheists, the Israelites enter monolatrous, and they leave monotheist. When the Israelites come back, we have the first unambiguous descriptions of monotheism in Isaiah, 2 Isaiah written after their turn. 1 Isaiah was written before, 2 Isaiah after. After their turn, we have phrases like this. Thus saith Jehovah, the King of Israel and his Redeemer, Jehovah of hosts, I am the first, I am the last, besides me there is no God. This, of course, contradicts the things we just read earlier that said there was. That people may know from the rising of the sun and the front from the west that there is none besides me. I am Jehovah, there is no other. I form the light and create darkness. I make well-being and create calamity. I am Jehovah who does all these things. So they entered polytheists, they left monotheists. Which, of course, brings us to Christianity, which we're not going to cover, unfortunately. But its genius and why it spread was that they took this idea of the monotheistic God and combined it with something people could relate to. God himself became man so that we could come to know God. In a world that was struggling with the Greek philosophical concept of God, mixed with this idea of the gods being too human to be taken seriously, Christianity created a balance that was incredibly attractive to the people. They flocked to it in droves, and the first great monotheistic religion that would actually convert large numbers of people was born. Through the combination of making God like us and the idea that there is, in fact, only one God. Of course, the problem with that is they had to reconcile Christ and God, and they came up with this complicated thing called the Trinity, and people had a hard time believing that. Enter the Muslims, and their main thesis was the Trinity is wrong, God had no son, God could have no son, there is only one God. All this Trinity talk is apostasy. And that was the main message that was different about Islam, was to go back to the Jewish concept of a single, unified, one God, and to throw out this idea of Jesus as the Son of God or as God made flesh. There's one other concept that I want to mention, and I want to mention it because this is a concept that I find compelling. It's perhaps best expressed in the Upanishads, but it's also in Buddhism, and you can find it in forms of Islam. That take the unity of God so seriously that God becomes all that is. This idea is that the concept of me as a separate self is an illusion. I am not separate from you. You are not separate from me. We are one. We are all part of the same universe. We are all dependent on each other, and we're all interconnected. And if I am not different from you and you are not different than me, then none of us are different from God because we are all God, because God is all that is. By the way, the argument between atheists and theists today takes place in the battleground of the Christian Islamic conception of monotheism. But we should be asking, I believe, a very different question. Not does God exist, because I don't know, but what do we choose to think of as God? What is God like? Because if we define God as simply all that is, and we are part of all that is, and we are one with God, then it's very hard to say that God doesn't exist. The definition of whether God exists depends on how you define God, which should be a very obvious point to everyone. God may or may not exist as defined in specific ways, but until we define what we're talking about, it's very difficult to say whether God exists or not. There's, of course, one other way you can reach the same conclusion of this that we had with this pantheistic conclusion, and that is through quantum mechanics and the Big Bang. We could have a long discussion about this. It's not why they believed it, but one of the reasons you might believe it is because all things exist as a single wave function, all entangled, all coming from a single prime cause, etc. And that unity from which all of our separate natures and consciousness spring is God, according to this particular view. Now, what I've given you is some history. Let's talk about the point, and then we're done. I believe that the greatest problem our world faces is not that some people believe in God and are willing to kill in his name. It's not that some people don't believe in God and we're taking God out of our schools. The problem with the world is extremism of all sorts and all shapes. This is my personal belief. And it is dogmatism. And I believe that history is the great cure for fundamentalism. Because once we see where our beliefs come from, once we see how they've evolved through time, we don't have to give them up, but we at least have to see them in a new light, at the very least. Because we begin to realize that people have believed a great many things over time. And the chance that we are right and everyone else is wrong is probably pretty small. And that creates, I believe, the humility needed to then approach these questions with curiosity, because we no longer have to have the right answer to be saved. We no longer have to have the right answer to convince everyone else to solve the world's problems. We can just see them with curiosity, and we can see the impact on human nature and human psyche that grows from them. It matters where monotheism came from. It matters whether we view God as a being just like us with a white beard and long hair living up in the sky who rules as king of the earth. It leads to some of our political problems. It causes people to fly airplanes into buildings, and it leads people to great acts of love and compassion. The better question isn't, does God exist, but what is God? And what does God want from us? I don't know. But I would rather have questions I can't answer than answers I can't question. I do know that God is not like us. God's desires are not our individual desires. He does not share our politics and our particular mode of beliefs to be imposed on others. Our politics, our morality, and our religions are ours. I hope we can find a way to own them. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed what you've heard here and would like to know more about the Unitarian Church of Los Alamos or Unitarian Universalism, please visit us on the web at www.uulosalamos.org or visit us in real space, 1738 North Sage Street in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Join us again next week.